Hello, everyone. I'm Josh Rushing, filling in for Femi Okay. Life has changed dramatically for people in Ukraine since Russia invaded a week ago. Today, we talk to them about what they're going through, what lies ahead, and what they want the international community to know. Now, look, if you're watching this live on YouTube, see the box right there? There's a live producer waiting to get your comments to us so that I can get them in the show and you, too, can be in the stream. Civilian casualties in Ukraine are growing as Russia steps up its attacks on major cities. The United Nations human rights chief said the military offensive is putting tens of millions of people in the country in potentially mortal danger. The UN says that more than 1 million people have fled Ukraine in the past week, and at least another million people are displaced within the country itself. We spoke to Ala, a 15-year-old high school student who fled Kyiv with her family, about what her life is like now. Have a listen.
Ukrainian students, Ukrainian children and teenagers have not been going to the school for a week, despite the fact that everyone have law for education, everyone have rights for it. And we don't know when we'll be able to go to school again. Unfortunately, traveling through Ukraine, through different cities, is really dangerous now. And the question about leaving Ukraine is more for my parents. It's not for me. I can't make such strong decisions by myself. We believe in Ukraine. We believe in Ukrainian army. We're not in Kyiv now, but we really hope to come back home. Glory to Ukraine. Slava Ukraini.
Joining us to discuss what's happening is Andriy Shevchenko. He is the former ambassador to Canada for Ukraine and is now in the capital, Kyiv. We also have Katerina Molofieva. She is a producer for Al Jazeera English and is based in Dnipro. And finally, Tatiana Pachonchik. She is the CEO of Human Rights Center Zamina and is in the Ukraine, but we're not disclosing your location for safety reasons. Katerina, can we start with you? Can you bring us up to date? What's the latest?
Well, I'm currently in Dnipro because this is the safest place probably to be at the moment as Russian troops are approaching from different directions to different cities of Ukraine. But every day, together with my team, we travel to other places. Let's say we worked in the past couple of days in Zaporizhia, visited the hospital for kids where, the city is very... The Russian troops are approximately 30 kilometers away from the city. And the, during the sirens, the small kids who some of them have terminal diseases have to go down, have to be carried down to the basement. Today we tried to approach Kharkiv. We thought about coming there, but still, you know, the road is still unsafe. On the way to Kharkiv, the road was empty. On the way out, there was a lot of traffic, queues of lines of cars with stickers on the window, children. So people were fleeing the city. And
hey, Katerina, can I ask you, as you get closer to the lines, is there kind of a constant danger on both sides of the line for you as a journalist?
Well, it is. There is no safe place in Ukraine at mm-hmm. all at the moment, simply because the air is not protected from above. So, in the course of the past 6 days, there was a Russian helicopter flying very close to us, and after that, there was a rocket fire. So, maybe 100 meters away, the shell landed. So, apart from that, you can imagine that territorial defense units, they are still very nervous. These are just civilians who decided to protect their land, and everyone is nervous at the checkpoint. It's very unsafe, so there are a lot of thorough checks conducted by them. And in fact, the danger can come from anywhere at the moment. So
yes,
let's say
I can also add to it and confirm that I was in Kyiv first days of the war. I woke up last Thursday from the explosion sound in my apartment in Kyiv and stayed there 5 days. Every day and night the city is bombed, and we had to go to the shelters in the underground parking of our building or to the metro station and spending nights on the platforms of the metro or in the underground parking or because in the multi-store building is dangerous in Kyiv. And we see that situation is getting worse and worse. Of civilians are already killed in this war.
Yes, they are, Tatiana. And Andriy, can we bring you into discussion? You're in Kyiv now, still, right? You've remained in Kyiv?
Yes, I'm in Kyiv, which remains a free capital of this unbroken nation. And we are entering the ninth night of this massive Russian offensive. And the Russians usually choose the night hours for most of their airstrikes, which means that every hour or two there are airstrike sirens and we have to go to shelters. So this means it's another sleepless night for many Ukrainians across the country. And again, whether you're in Kyiv or in Chernihiv or in Kharkiv or in any other places, it's very difficult to feel safe this time.
And how's your family holding up, Andriy?
My wife is a news presenter, so she works from her studio in downtown Kyiv. So actually, that means that she, just like many other people, she does her best during these very difficult times, because all of us, we can understand how important it is to provide good news coverage and provide good information to the audience. And we have two daughters who are 17 and 3, and they're with us in the suburbs of Kyiv. So we are here, and we believe that we will get through this, and we shall overcome.
But I'm curious, as a father, like, how are the kids holding up, and what do you tell them to get them through this?
Well, the older one is very focused and very serious, and I think she understands the situation quite well. And the 3 years old, I guess she still has the war stories to be told to her later on. And I hope she will never be able to comprehend all these situations the way we do.
I want to bring in a soundbite from President Zelensky, who presented this message in Russia recently, in Russian.
You cut the Ukrainian civilians off electricity, water supply, heating. You leave the people without food. You leave us without medicines. You shoot the routes which could be used for evacuation. There is no weapon left that you wouldn't deploy against us, against free citizens of Ukraine. And now you have come forward and you tell your propaganda mouthpieces that you are going to send to Ukraine so-called humanitarian convoys. Remember, you the godless, when millions of people curse you, there would be nothing to save you. We have nothing to lose but our own freedom, besides our own dignity. This is our greatest treasure.
I clearly need to correct what I said there. He's speaking Ukrainian there. But what he said is interesting, that he's talking about bombing the evacuation routes. Breaking right now is an agreement between Russian and Ukrainian forces to set up evacuation routes to get out civilian casualties and to get medicines in. I'm curious, do you think his message is being heard? Andriy?
I don't think his message is heard. Definitely his message is not heard by the Russians. They don't care. And I'm afraid this message, our cry for help, is not heard around the world yet. And Josh, I know that you've seen many terrible war situations and you've covered a lot. And many people do not realize that there are actually international laws for wars that actually set up rules of engagement. The Russians don't care about that. They use cluster bombs to attack apartment blocks in Kharkiv. They use Ukrainian flags to mask their tanks. They deliberately target civilian infrastructure. They captured Chernobyl nuclear plant, posing huge threat to the whole continent. There was one situation in Kyiv when they hijacked ambulance vehicles to sneak into downtown and to do a terrorist attack. The Russian losses by this time are more than 6,000, both lethal and non-lethal, and we cannot even convince the Russians to take back the bodies of their soldiers. So they do behave like barbarians with no dignity, and it's pure evil which must be stopped. And going back to your question, I don't see the Russians actually getting this message. I don't see the Russians actually starting thinking about humanitarian issues.
And Tatiana, what have you seen in terms of war crimes? Yeah, I see you want to jump in. Go for it.
I can only confirm what Andriy said. As human rights defenders, we document war crimes amid this conflict and all the gravest war crimes and crimes against humanity are happening across Ukraine, across our cities and villages every day. And it's happening like dozens per hour. The amount is so huge. They are shelling our infrastructure, the buildings where peaceful people live, hospitals, kindergartens, schools. They killed hundreds of civilians, including children. The morgues are full, and they rob the shops and houses of the people in the captured territories. And this is a huge humanitarian disaster now, which is affecting at least 12 million people who desperately need housing, food, water supply, medicine. And we have to do everything possible to be united to stop this aggression.
We actually have a piece of video here from the International Committee for the Red Cross, ICRC, about these very laws we're talking about.
The thing that we need the most to prevent civilian suffering is for the parties to the conflict to follow international humanitarian law. These are the rules, the laws that govern armed conflict, and they were created to preserve humanity in wartime. Now, our teams are on the ground. They're doing what they can. For example, in Mariupol today, our team has been delivering medical supplies to different hospitals in the area. And yesterday, that team delivered things like hygiene items, food and water to about 4,000 people who have been living in shelters in Mariupol. But we know that this is just a drop in the ocean to the full scale of the needs in Ukraine. And we are scaling up and we want to be able to do more. But we need to be able to move about safely to deliver that assistance to people who need it.
Katarina, it looked like you wanted to jump in there.
Yes, one of the most interesting moments here is that I have majority of my family living in Russia. I've been offered help from many friends across Europe and in the US, in the UK. Messages of support even coming from Yemen or Syria on my Twitter account, for example. But none of my relatives offered me any help. Neither supported me on this situation. They just said, for example, my cousin blocked me because she decided to be deaf from hearing that. I keep sending my uncle in Vladikavkaz photos and pictures, and just they are saying that they definitely follow the Russian propaganda and saying that Russia only target the military facilities and not the civilians, as if they want to stay blind. Although even in this situation, I think that it might be changing. In the course of the 8th day, now when we see the damages, when they see damages and destructions and the civilian casualties and the Russian soldiers who are captured and who wants to go back home, telling on the video how they were abandoned by their commanders or simply shut down. Well, today something happened. One of them, colleague from the Kremlin media started posting on Instagram messages and videos of wanting to stop this. So messages of preventing this war, because he finally realized that it's not just a military operation against so-called Nazis or neo-Nazis. It's something that is ruining the neighboring country. So I think that the most important message is, I know that Europe will hear us, but I want also that the Russians hear us, listen to our voices and our cries and our suffering. Only this can change the course of the history.
But Katarina, I'm curious, from your relatives in Russia, do you have a sense of how much information they can get outside of the Russian propaganda?
I think they just want to be blind. You know, they don't have access to the Telegram channels, and as far as I understand, the Telegram channels will be also banned, and Facebook limited access. So they only watch Kremlin propaganda coming from the state media, such as Russia One, First Channel. So they just don't want to accept. So, and I keep sending them messages when if I will die, my blood is on your consciousness, in your hands. So you just remember about that. I don't think they want to believe that.
Oh, Andre, I want to throw some YouTube comments at you. Well, go ahead. What were you going to say first?
If I may jump in to support what Katya was just saying, I think it would be very naive to think that Putin is just the source of the problems here. I think in many ways, unfortunately, he is a reflection of the Russian ruling class and the Russian public. We know that about 50% of the Russian population supported this invasion into Ukraine even before it is started. So I think that explains us that we are dealing with something very serious, and this threat is not going to be over once Putin is gone. And we have to take it very seriously.
Speaking of Putin, we have a piece of video from Putin that, here, take a listen to this.
I will never give up my conviction that Russians and Ukrainians are one people. Even though some people in Ukraine have been intimidated, many have been duped by Nazi and nationalist propaganda. But some have deliberately gone the way of the Banderites and other Nazi henchmen. Dear comrades, I want to say that the special military operation is proceeding strictly in line with the timetable. According to plan, all the tasks that have been set are being successfully resolved.
So, Andrei, Putin's saying there that some people have fallen victim to Nazi propaganda. And he's also saying that they're meeting all of their objectives. I'm sharing a map right now on my laptop showing the basic places that the Russian forces are and what they control. My guess is from the things he was saying in the early days of the war, this is not where he expected to be by this day.
Exactly. And I'll just say that none of Putin's historical hallucinations can be an excuse for killing thousands of Ukrainian civilians and for destroying our cities. None of his historical hallucinations and illusions. But speaking of what is actually happening on the ground, I think it's quite obvious that Putin has broken his teeth on Ukraine. They thought in 48 hours they would control Kyiv and we would be begging for peace on their terms. I think it's quite obvious that our armed forces have given a very impressive fight to the invaders. They feel quite confident on land. One of the reasons why this is happening is because many civilians have taken arms, and I think my colleagues from the panel have tons of stories about people like that. Civilians who have taken arms and joined the forces of territorial defense. And that explains you why every Ukrainian city or village has become a fortress these days, and why every street becomes a battlefield and true hell for the Russians. What I see around me here in Kyiv, in the suburbs of Kyiv, all over the place, in Kharkiv, in Chernihiv, I see extraordinary courage. I see a lot of self-sacrifice, which is very touching. And there is a lot of anger. There is a lot of fury. But also there is a lot of optimism and there is a lot of enthusiasm.
Hey, Tatiana, have you been up to the border? I'd like to shift this to the border situation. The million Ukrainians that are fleeing. We actually have a piece of video from one young lady, Krinsky, who was at the border recently. Here, let's share this.
A lot of segregation and racism from the people who managed to actually get to the passport control. It seems that there's a hierarchy of Ukrainians first, Indians second, Africans last. So there has been a lot of segregation.
Hey, I want to throw in a comment from the YouTube audience here. This is from Romeo B. He says, why are you ignoring the racial discrimination on the Poland-Ukraine border. Well, we're not. We just hadn't gotten to it yet. But she was saying it seems like that there's some racial discrimination going on at the border. Have you seen or witnessed any of that, Tatiana?
We checked this story several days and collected a lot of information from foreign students, also black people trying to leave Ukraine. And the reason for this is a war and a catastrophic situation on the borders. Also, the problems at the beginning was that while Ukrainians have visa-free regime with EU countries, some foreign citizens, foreign students didn't have visa to enter EU countries. So we called to all EU countries to open their borders and to let everyone in. But it is also important that during this big lines and stacks on the borders, women's children were let for the first in the first place to cross the border, and then men, regardless black or white they are. And I think this is also important message to deliver. But also I would like to come back to the numbers that 1 million people left Ukraine. We have also almost 100,000 people who came to Ukraine after the beginning of the war, and majority of them are men. Among these people are four men from my family, my father, my husband, and two of my cousins came back to Ukraine, and they already, they are not military men, but they already registered for the territorial defense unit.
Yeah, I hear a million Ukrainians fleeing, and I think, well, that means 43 million are staying. Andrei, are you thinking of leaving or staying?
Not at all. And I'm a reservist officer, so I'm actually waiting for orders for me, where I can be deployed and where I can be useful for my country. And we are staying here. And just one comment on the foreigners in Ukraine. I actually know that there was a heroic attempt, successful attempt to get foreign students out of Kharkiv. And that was specifically organized by the Ukrainian government just to make sure that foreigners, they have a safe passage out of Kharkiv, out of the country. If you think about this 1 million strong city, which was half surrounded by the Russians, there was an attempt to surround it, which was being destroyed by the Russian airstrikes. And under these absolutely tragic and terrible circumstances, the local government was had as the high priority to get foreign students out of the city into a safe place. And again, when it comes to the borders, if you think about 1 million people crossing the border in a couple of days, it might be nasty. And again, Ukrainians have visa-free regime with the European Union. That means if you show Ukrainian passport, you just walk across the border. So I just want to reassure that anyone, everyone, anyone who has been to Ukraine, he knows that this is a very diverse country. It's a very multicultural country, and it's a very friendly place for all the foreigners, and we hope it will always be.
I want to add about people who already left their homes in 2014. I'm one of them. So people who are at the moment considered as IDPs. You probably saw the videos from Irpin on the city on the outskirts of Kyiv. It's just absolutely shocking images of devastating damages of the city. This is a town which where mostly the IDPs from Donetsk and Lugansk region relocated and purchased the houses after they had to flee the war in 2014. So for such people like them and like myself, this is a double trauma. For a second time in my life, I'm losing the ground under my feet. And this is extremely difficult because in 2014, people did have a choice where to go. They could flee to the safe place in Ukraine, or they could go to Moscow, depending on their inclination or relatives living on this or another side. At the moment, Ukraine is a total war right now. So for such people, for IDPs, this is for 1.5 million population, twice in their lifetime to experience this trauma once again.
Katriana, thank you for that. Andrei, thank you. And Tatiana, thank you. Thank you for taking time out of your life right now. I know it's not easy, but sharing these stories with us so the world can see what's actually happening there in Ukraine. And of course, Al Jazeera English will continue to follow this very important story.